RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
Bob Dylan, Simon & Garfunkel, ABBA, The Rolling Stones, The Eagles, Michael Jackson, Rod Stewart, Stevie Wonder, Lady Gaga and Adele are just a few of the pop world's elite who have been enhanced in their performance by the sensitive and often spectacular lighting by my guest today, Patrick Woodroffe. For over four decades, he has trailblazed and innovated from the early analog days of static lights to the array of digital technology available today in this very specialized area of creativity. But his palette is much wider than the international pop scene. He has lit for musicals, opera, architecture, theatre and film, and on a single evening in 2012, he reached a global audience of 900 million people with his spectacular lighting scheme for the London Olympics opening ceremony. He has received many accolades along the way, including being made a Royal Designer for Industry and receiving an OBE for his services to the arts. I spoke to Patrick in a break from his busy schedule in the tranquil garden of his home in Bath. Now, you were born in Oxford in June 1954.
Yeah.
So that makes you a Gemini. So this is
a Gemini,
bit of frivolity. I just want to talk about the trait. So Geminis are powerful intellectuals with a combination of creative talent and business skills, expressive, quick-witted, outgoing, flirtatious, communicative, and lots of fun.
You've got it in one.
That's the positive side. The other side is you can be serious, restless, and indecisive. Now it seems to be the complete opposite. It's because there are two sides. Is that vaguely...
Well, I think it is vaguely true, but I think the first three of those four things are not pejoratives at all. I think indecisive is maybe a little bit of a pejorative, but I think I'm everything that you've said to some degree, I would say.
Let's start by rolling back to your childhood. Where were you born?
I was born in Oxford. My father was... A military soldier. And so at the age of three, I was living in Singapore. That's where my first earliest memories were. And I can remember learning to swim, and I can remember the kind of romance of travel. Although I sometimes think, as I imagine those early memories of mine, whether they actually come from Ladybird books and whether they actually happened to me, or whether I lived in this kind of nice halcyon period of the early 50s when everything was perfect and people played and foreigners accosted you on the street and sold you things.
And presumably, if you were in Singapore, you would have had servants.
And we had servants, yeah. Interestingly, I went back. I was in Singapore doing some shows with the Stones a few years ago. 4 years ago. And I knew that we lived on Sherwood Road, and I thought it was number 35, I can't remember. And I got somebody to take me down there, and they said, oh, Sherwood Road's, all the houses have gone now, because they built the Chinese embassy there or something. But two houses still remained, and one of them was the house that I grew up. I was 5 years old when I left there. But I looked at it, and the first time I went and looked at it, I didn't really recognize it. But I took some pictures, and over the next 24 hours back in my hotel, I was looking at the pictures. It slowly started coming back to me. In other words, it's all there somewhere, you know, in the hard drive. So I went back the next day and banged on the door. And a very nice Australian banker let me in. And I said, look, I used to live here. Would you mind if I have a look around? He said, no, of course not. And it was amazing how it came back to me exactly as a movie. The staircase and sitting at the top of the stairs and the servants' quarters at the back where we used to go and play as kids, and the garden, and where the Chinese armor, Ah Ho, used to teach us to spit at the Chinese sitting by the side of the road. It was amazing, really, and quite a powerful emotional thing, and going to the little church up the road where we used to go on Sundays, and the Tanglen Swimming Club where we... And there was a poignancy about, you know, imagining that little child and thinking of all the things that's happened to me in the intervening 60 years, nearly.
And then your father then was posted on to Germany, is that...?
Then we went to live in Germany when I was... up until the age of about seven. And there we lived outside the camp. It was a big camp. He was in charge of intelligence. He was quite a powerful soldier, my father, and a rather great man, you know, very diffident and didn't really say much about it. I learnt a lot about him after he died. He got a DSO and he was always very modest about that, but I learnt of the circumstances in which he got it. I was proud of him. So in Germany, we lived outside the camp, so I learnt to speak German and went to kindergarten with German children and and eventually ended up going to boarding school at the age of 7, which seems criminal now, back to UK. I guess if it was anything that was formative to what happened to me afterwards, it taught me to get on with people, taught me probably not so healthily to be deferential to difficult, complicated single men who ran our lives. There were no women there. But one found a way to communicate, and I think in retrospect I rather enjoyed it. I went on to Marlborough public school after that.
Were you very academic?
Not really. I mean, it was classic, you know, just managed to get by doing the minimum. Was quite good at padding out essays without knowing that much about the subject. But I was into art. I went from prep school, I went to Marlborough, but I was chucked out of Marlborough and I ended up going to a school for kind of rich foreigners, a lot of Persians, Turks, Saudi royal family, Osama bin Laden's brother, and some kind of English dropouts. But I think there and the education wasn't very good, but it was a very good education on how to get on with people. And it was a very good education about how people, particularly people who are not from our culture or country, are different. Have different ways of
good
working,
good,
you know,
training for
really
later.
Good training. So that really taught me. I mean, and I ended up having a life of travel. I've traveled enormously over the last 40, 50 years, 100,000 miles a year, I reckon I do on average, certainly did. And just immersed in these different cultures. So
tell me a little bit about, you know, you said you were more artistic and you went to this other school after being dropped from Marlborough. Mm. How did that develop itself, the creative side?
I don't know. I mean, I like the theatre. I mean, I just don't think that education was very good anywhere in those days. They never made learning interesting. I mean, I think I do a little bit of teaching myself now, and it's so interesting. Maybe I have a subject that's a bit more interesting than physics or something, but it's so easy to bring subjects to life, and people never used to do that. And the only ones that really brought to life for me were English. And English literature and theatre, and I used to be in the school plays and all that sort of thing. And I used to like art, and I used to like painting and arranging things, putting things into order, were very much the sorts of things that skills that come about as one ended up lighting shows later than that.
So when you finally left that...
With one poor A-level, yeah.
In what?
In English literature.
Oh, right, okay. So what did you do?
Well, I didn't go to university. I don't know if that was ever on the cards. I immediately wanted to do something interesting and different, and I remember applying for jobs to be a stuntman in a horse show and sailing on a boat with Greenpeace to Namibia, and none of them really came to fruition. But already I was thinking, well, there's no way I was going to be an architect or a lawyer or a banker, or because I didn't have the qualifications for it.
So you didn't have a real focus at that?
Absolutely no focus. I wanted to be... I remember once I left, and the first job I got was being a gardener for a company called London Gardens, you know, gardening in public spaces in London, private gardens, public spaces. I remember once in my lunch hour finding a copy of the Daily Express, and there was a centrefold spread about being a stuntman in a James Bond movie, and I thought, that's me. That's my life. I could travel around the world, staying in nice hotels, doing exciting things and meeting interesting people, which is exactly
what
I ended up doing, without the danger of having to jump off a building, I guess.
Okay, so then how did you...
Because my brother, who was quite an influence on me, my brother was 2 years older.
Simon. Yeah.
Who went on to run Yo Sushi, create Yo Sushi.
Yes.
And Simon also was a dropout in his own way from school, left school early and ended up doing some quite sort of hippie things, making hippie clothes and stuff. But he had somehow fallen into the music business, sort of as a roadie, I think. And he took me out on a couple of gigs. I would have been 17 years old, maybe. And I thought it was so exciting. You know, in these funny... I can't remember what the name of the first band was. Mojo Hannah. It was a band called The Sweet. And it was the lead singer from The Sweet had gone off. So that's how kind of far down the totem pole I started. And but I remember thinking this was really exciting. And then he had done some work with a lighting company, and lighting companies were very small in those. There was only really one lighting company in England called ESP Lighting. And I got a job. I think the first proper job I had was to be a follow spot operator at a David Cassidy concert at White City, where rather tragically 3 girls were killed, I seem to remember, in a crowd thing. It was unusual in those days. I ended up doing that through Simon's encouragement, I guess. And I worked for ESP Lighting. It's a little company in the back streets of Borough, near Borough Market. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was Borough Market. It was Glasshill Street. And there we would, you know, load lighting rigs into 3-ton trucks and do tours of England and Europe. We'd drive ourselves. There would be somebody who was sort of in charge of running the lights, but it was seemed to be rather ad hoc. You know, will you do the lights tonight? And occasionally a band from America would come over with a lighting designer, this rather esoteric title that no one quite knew what they were or what they did. But we would put up lighting rigs, which were basically parkans on towers. No trusses, no flying, no moving lights, no automation. Only parkans were the only fixtures we used, parkans with gels in them. And we would put them together and tape up the cables and put them in. Didn't we have road boxes into, you know, laundry hampers? And I mean, it was really... But still, when I think about it, some of those... Then I think the first sort of proper show I did was with Queen, proper tour I did was with Queen. That would have been 1973 or 1975, as the third man on the lighting crew. But that had a little bit of order to it and had a bit of theatricality to it, you know, and the lighting was... It was a very nice man called James Dan who used to do the lighting. And... that had some consideration to it, and I remember thinking that was rather good.
Was
and
that
I,
before you got the Rod Stewart?
Yes, it was before. So then there was a very nice period. There was a very interesting guy called Ricky Farr who ran the Isle of Wight Festivals. He was this rather big impresario. And he managed a band called the Heavy Metal Kids, which was this kind of pre-bunk punk era band. And he said, although they had very little money, he said, we want our own lighting person. We think that's going to make a big difference to the way this band was presented. And so I spent a year travelling with them with 24 parkans on two towers and went all over Europe and England. But I think that's where I learnt pretty much, certainly where I developed any sort of signature style I have, which is to really consider things from number, to use colour very sparingly and never to mix colours up and to learn timing. All that stuff I learnt as I traipsed up and down staircases carrying bass bin speakers and lights. And then I did get my break with Rod Stewart. My brother by this time had gone on to start a lighting company, I remember, with Ricky Farr. And I used to go out again, sort of took a step back, going out as part of the lighting crew, helping to set the stuff up. But Rod Stewart fired his lighting designer 4 days before the tour started. And it was my brother Simon who said, you got to take the job. And I was really nervous. No, I can't do it. I don't know. This is all too grown up. And he was emphatic about it. And he said, there's only one person here who can do this. It's Patrick. He's been working with the Heavy Metal Kids. And they went, oh, okay. And suddenly I had, it was the sort of dream break that
everyone
gets.
So that was
gets.
You as an independent lighting
and
designer.
And bam, that was the beginning. A week later, I was in Trondheim in Norway. So nervous about doing this show, but not as nervous as Rod Stewart and his band. It was his first big break, solo career before, after he split up from the Faces. So they were very nervous. But then followed this halcyon, two big world tours in 77 and 79, where I travelled around the world. I was 24 years old, 25 years old. And I mean, it was very different now. That crew, there were only eight of us on the crew.
Which is tiny, isn't it?
Tiny. On a world tour now, we take 280 on the... And that was a big tour in its time.
Well, that brings me on to, I mean, obviously then it was the analog days. I mean, everything was really rather primitive.
Yeah.
So tell me, how did you explain how you were going to light something? You know, if I'm a performer, band or lead singer, and I'm saying, well, what are you going to do? How did you, was it sketches or?
No, I think they left it up to you a lot more. They would, you know, their concerns would be if it wasn't bright enough, or they couldn't see the audience, or if their manager would say, you know, don't use colour in the spotlights because I want to see him. I think it was probably much the same conversations I have now, but certainly without a way to illustrate it. Now, of course, you can make not only pictures and sketches, you can make beautiful computer drawings, you can make whole animations, you can make a whole show on a computer.
You can indeed.
But I think it would have been the same thing. And what I certainly learnt in those days is the importance of making a relationship with the person that you were working with. Because, you know, I understood that this was not just doing the lights. This was much more about having some understanding about who they were and what they wanted. You know, there's a big difference to lighting ABBA than it was to lighting Rod Stewart or Tina Turner or whoever the people
I
was working with.
So I guess you've got to spend time to gauge their personality, be it the persona that they have on stage, which often is quite different from off stage. So you've got to understand that.
Exactly that. And certainly that's a skill I've learnt over the years, is that when they say something, it's not necessarily what they actually want. You know, I don't want any spotlights, you know, can mean in my eyes because it hurts my eyes or something like that. Can actually mean I'm nervous about being seen so much, and can you be more subtle? Or I don't like blue means, I don't know, it means something else, but that's something I've certainly learned how to understand it. Also to understand that the biggest stars in the world are still incredibly insecure about their performance. And and that's something that I think, in the end, my job certainly was to encourage their confidence and self-confidence. I've been unbelievably, you know, even somebody like Mick Jagger, you know, the world's greatest solo performer on stage, is not nervous about his performance, but absolutely open to talking about how it should be and how he should perform and where he should come on and whether he should work that side of the stage and how did I think it should work. That's a shorthand I've built up over the years.
So I think 32 years you've been...
35. I think I'm certainly the longest serving employee, I say now with some pride.
That is a long time.
Yeah, it is, 30-something years, 35 years, yeah.
And on that relationship, which is, you know, probably the longest relationship anyone has had with a major international band.
Yeah, maybe. I'm sure there are people of my age who've worked just with one band or worked with people for a long time. But yeah, it's got to be getting up there, I imagine. Yeah.
How involved are they with, I mean, the entire group, or is it Mick Jagger?
It's all different from different bands. You know, there are some bands who are very specific about what they want. Some are just more than happy to have you there and whatever you want to do is fine by them. The Stones, I worked with the first time in 1982 and had very little to do with them. I had a European tour. I think I met Mick. I don't even think I met the others. I met Mick really briefly. Yeah. I met Mick the first show we did was a warm-up show for a European tour, Still Life tour, and it was in a theatre in Aberdeen. It was a warm-up show we did. And I was taken down to meet Mick in the dressing room. I guess I'd never met him before, by the manager or somebody. He said, "It's Patrick. He's going to be making the lighting for us on this tour. Have you got any tips, anything you want to tell him, any direction?" And Mick said very laconically, "Well, I guess that would be bright for the fast number and darker for the ballads." And something I've stuck to in the 35 years that followed. But then the Stones had a hiatus after that tour in 82. They weren't getting on with each other very well. And from 82 to 89, they didn't work as a band. But Mick was building a solo career. So I went and did some tours with him in Indonesia, Japan, Australia. And that was a much smaller production. We were playing in small arenas. A much smaller crew. And then I got to know him really quite well. And that's when, and he was obviously really looking to do interesting different things then, because he was solo, he could afford to do more theatrical things. So there was a nice relationship built up in those 2 or 3 years. So when the band got back together again in 89, it was, you know, sort of matter of course that I would be the person who would certainly do the lighting and start to be involved on a slightly wider scale and sort of some sort of creative direction of how not just the lighting but the video and the stage set and all those things combined to make a show. And that's really when I started working with them for the first time as a group and meeting the others and getting some understanding of the dynamic there, you know.
I mean, although you're not a musician yourself, you're working with lots of musicians and you are really composing with light.
Yeah,
I guess,
absolutely,
because and certainly with all of the modern iterations of lighting that have happened over the last 15-20 years, they become even more complex but give you a wider palette of what you can do.
It is only the greatest job in the world. It's a fantastic job, because it's particularly if you start working in different fields, but for sure in something as straightforward as a rock concert, you're absolutely painting with light.
Yeah.
And as soon as we started to get moving lights and automated systems, then of course the thing took off enormously. You have this canvas as your stage. It's such an obvious analogy. And the lights are your paints, and the control board is your brush, or however you want to characterize it. But yeah, to really understand what it is that you're interpreting, and I think this is the real skill, because nowadays with these lighting systems, pretty much anyone can make anything look fabulous. You know, you've got a couple of hundred moving lights, and you make them all blue and sweep them into the audience, and of course it's going to look wonderful. But the skill is to do that for a real reason.
Yes.
You know, if you're making an opera, you do it for reasons of the score and the narrative. If you're doing it for a rock concert, you're doing it the emotion of the song and the musicality of the song and the structure of the song. But you're also looking at a show, a two-hour show, where you have to have some real light and shade, so you're not giving away too much. A lot of it is about restraint. So that changed our lives. And why we had moving lights is interesting. You know, when I first started working with these bands, we were playing, I'm trying to think of a big Rod Stewart tour that we played at Olympia, was our London show. And we were really playing big theatres, city halls. That's where bands would play in those days. Mm-hmm. And you could get away with the first lighting rig that had 100 park amps was considered revolutionary in its time. But slowly but surely, bands started to move from playing in big theatres to arenas, and particularly in America, started working in the sports arenas. And people started to think, and then they started to make some money, because you could charge, you know, you're suddenly playing a 60-date tour of America in arenas that were holding 18,000 people each. And even if you were only getting $25 a ticket or something, that still started to be a lot of money. And then when we went into stadia, then for sure that was a time when people started to say, look, we're making a lot of money, but we need to put on a proper show. This was even before video screens. We need to put on a big show. We need to have good lighting. We got some money to spend. Genesis famously invented the very light, moving light. And they invented that mainly because they would play shows in America, and the follow spots, which were the lights that would be operated by men, usually older men who weren't very interested in rock music, stagehands, never would hit them at the right time. So they said, can't we make a light that would move so that, you know, we could syncopate it with our music? And that was the birth of the VL1. So from that, there were a relatively small group of us who were involved, I would say, in creating these big rock shows, you know, less than 100, I would have thought, worldwide, who really had some influence on the technology that we were using, the form of things, how we started to develop video screens, how we started to develop stage sets. Now it's an enormous industry, huge industry. But it was really interesting time, and I think that suddenly was where lighting designers had a real creative role in terms of how you could create this amazing spectacle or simple, moving, emotional moments made simply with light.
Well, you talked a little bit just now about the other areas. I just want to list, first of all, keeping with perform, you know, with the rock world, all the people you've actually lit: ABBA, Bob Dylan, The Police, Take That, Peter Gabriel, Simon and Garfunkel, Genesis, Stevie Wonder, Rod Stewart, The Eagles, Lady Gaga, Donna Summer, Elton John. You know, it's an incredible list of people. But you also have another side, where you've worked with the Vienna State Opera and Finnish National Opera and English National Ballet, which is a completely different world, really. Mm. I mean, I worked for many years with English National Opera as their design branding advisor. So I used to go to the model showings and, you know, the talk-throughs and so forth, and then watch rehearsals often. And I would be amazed at how the lighting aspects totally changed everything. And I could see how beautiful, emotional, poignant, dramatic, whatever, you can see what lighting can actually do. Do you have a particular, I mean, is that a rather, for you, a sort of a respite from the kind of frantic
It was a very specific time in my career when I thought, these rock bands aren't going to survive. You know, by this time I'd been working with the Rolling Stones for 10 years, but I thought they're going to be 50 soon. There's no way that they're going to keep going. Or no, I wasn't quite so naive, but I thought for sure there was a time on this where I was going to have to try and find some other things. And I did two things. One is I would travel a lot touring with these acts, and I would start to meet promoters and producers in other countries who, you know, and the third time I'd be in Paris that year with the third rock band I was there, they would say, look, you know, we have an artist we'd love you to come and work with. She's very big in France. No one would have heard her anywhere else. So I said, I'll do that. I'd like to do that. And most of my peers were wanting to work with a big American and English rock band. So I really like that. I still like traveling. And I ended up building up this list of clients in South America, in Europe, in Scandinavia, particularly in Japan, Australia, where I'd go and work with their top artists, the top artists in Brazil, who sold as many records as the Rolling Stones, Roberto Carlos. Nobody would have heard of him anywhere else. So that was one kind of extra string to my bow. And I ended up working with really great artists. And to this day, now I go back and the young designers who I was working with then have all gone on to become big designers in their own right in their countries. And the tiny lighting companies that I would help set up to some degree, I would help them buy equipment from Europe. So when I worked with the young, some of those young designers gone on to become great designers in their own right, the lighting companies that I would have helped set up to some degree by bringing equipment there, now a huge big lighting company. So that was one side of the way that I developed my career. I didn't think that rock bands would go on forever, or at least maybe I wanted to do something different anyway. But it was a deliberate choice to start looking for other work. And so I ended up working in television, in film, in opera, in special events. And I guess people would also come to us, you know, now that people knew that we use these big automated lighting systems, they wanted to use it in theatre. So we were all quite well placed to do that. So in answer to your question, I love doing different things. And I would say half my work now is not rock concerts. Mm. It's either, you know, musical theatre and hybrid. So
you've done Les Mis and Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah, but again, those were working with the existing lighting designers from those productions to do the big productions. So Cameron McIntosh, who I've known well over the years, would say, look, we're doing our big anniversary thing, or can we do a big thing in the Albert Hall to promote or to celebrate something? So we were starting to use these techniques that I had learnt in terms of doing big scale production, particularly in stadia and big arenas, using lighting, but using it with some restraint and artistry, which fitted perfectly when you started to think about things like musicals or opera. And deliberately, sometimes I'd be approached to do that because people from those worlds were interested in seeing a different way of interpreting music. So for example, I did a big I did a Romeo and Juliet in Vienna that 20 years ago, using only lighting, no scenery, not even a balcony, all done with lighting. And we managed to persuade the Staatsoper in Vienna to buy a big automated lighting system, which they still have to this day. I did the same thing in Helsinki, did a big show in Bregenz using these automated lighting systems, but not making it look like a discotheque, you know. Mm, in fact, even I remember being in Bregenz and the
that's by the
one on the water, and them say, can you do more, can you do more, can you have more special flashing effects, and because they were used to, they thought that's what they wanted to see. So it's really interesting use. And remember that it works the other way around, Mike, as well, that when I everything that I learned from opera I can now bring to architecture, or you know, when we lit the Majewski Gardens at the V&A, you know, that's lit as if it were a theatrical stage set.
Well, let's just talk about probably the one thing that you've done that probably more people have seen on a single moment in time than anything else you've done, and that's the 2012 Olympic opening and closing ceremony, but particularly the opening, because that was the, you know, the sort of beginning, which was an astonishing piece of work, full stop, with Danny Boyle being the overarching director, and you lit all that, and so much of it was about, you know, the quality of the lighting, because it was when it became dark, and it was a huge canvas with so many people running around and different events going on and different stories. Tell me about that.
But I nearly didn't do it for a start. That was the first thing, and I knew that I was pretty well placed to be offered the job, or at least certainly be one of maybe only two or three people who would be, because I'm English and it would be an English lighting designer, and it would be somebody who had some experience of doing stuff at this scale. But I had really been bitten by doing the Millennium Dome, which turned out to be pretty great, but it was such a pain to be working with government and big organisations and this and that. And also there wasn't a great flavour about the Olympics 2 years before it started, you know. No one really knew who was in charge. We knew that we didn't have so much money, and for sure with the ceremonies we knew we had 1/10, 1/20 of what Beijing had spent, or even what Athens had spent. You know, it was going to be the austerity Olympics. I had no idea who the director was going to be, and it was complicated. And I thought, do I really want to put myself through, you know, a year and a half of this? And we wouldn't have made any money out of it. Not that was the reason for it, but they were not going to pay anybody's expenses. And I knew that there would be months of meetings and more meetings. And as I said, I didn't know who the director was. And I remember Mark Fisher, my great friend Mark Fisher, who died a couple of years later, who was sort of one of the executive producers. He was ill by that time. And I remember ringing him up saying, I'm not sure, Mark, because of this, and it's going to be like this, and that won't be this. And he said in his very laconic way, he said, well, of course you're right about all those things, Patrick. He said, all you have to ask yourself is on July the 18th or whatever it was, do you want to be in the control room at the stadium directing the lighting for the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games, or do you want to be at home watching it on the telly? So I said, you know what, I'll give it a go. And I was complicated It was fraught at times. We didn't have enough equipment, didn't have enough lights. We kept getting beaten up on the budget. When we turned everything on for the first time, I had a huge lurch in my tummy as I realized we didn't have enough lights. And ultimately, now when you start to do these big shows in stadia, that's all that really matters. You have to have enough lights. And you have to have enough lights not just to make wonderful effects and make it dramatic and exciting, simply to illuminate the people. And when I say I didn't have enough lights, I remember being in a big production meeting with Danny and all his team on one level of the stadium, looking out of the glass windows. And we'd had lights going on and off over the previous 3 weeks as we rigged stuff. But this was the first night that, bam, they turned all the lights on at the same time. And they were sort of waving around the place, and everyone in the control room was cheering and saying, great. And Danny kept turning to me, Patrick, this is going to be fantastic. And I knew simply by looking out the window that it wasn't going to be bright enough. And I remember texting up to my technicians up in the control room, you sure you've got the Grandmaster up at full? Are you sure you've done this? Are you sure you've done that? And the reason was not for what they call the cultural portions of the show, which were all the theatrical stuff. It was for the protocol moments, which are things like the entrance of the athletes, the oaths, the raising of the flag, all that stuff. And there you had to light the whole of the ring, the M25, we called it, the track, but you had to light it from three angles. Mm. You had to, at the same level, you had to light the whole of the infield where the other athletes would be waiting. Plus you had to light the audience, plus you had to light the stadium. Anyway, by hook or by crook, I remember the lovely producer, Catherine Ugly, went after I'd said, look, we've got a big issue here, taking me to one side and saying, I'm gonna find the extra money for you for the extra lighting on two conditions. And I said, what are those? She said, one is that you don't ask me for any more afterwards, and third is that you don't tell anybody that I did it, because of course every department was coming to her saying, I want a bit more. Anyway, I have to say, after that, it was an amazing experience. It was very difficult, rained all the time, things didn't work, you know, the rehearsals were not big, clean rehearsals. You know, you'd rehearse one portion of the show at a different time that it was going to be live in a different order than you'd done it the day before, and then it would rain and they would stop. We never really saw the show run at all.
Do you think that was...
until we got to the first rehearsal.
Was that the most complex thing you've ever done, do you think?
Yes, I think it was. I think it was complex for many reasons. You know, technical, creatively, a lot of stuff would be cut, started again. We had the big bonus we had were the pixels in the seats. And the pixels in the seats were Danny's idea. And I guess a lot of people have been playing around with, you know, making a huge video screen. But everyone did it with battery. And everyone did it with very small amount and rather crudely done. And Danny said, well, obviously that's not going to work. I need big pixels in each seat. And I think it was not his naivety, but the fact that he didn't really know about this technology that made him say the obvious, it's not bright enough. Anyway, Tate came up with this extraordinary way of actually hardwiring all the seats. But Danny only really wanted to use them three, four times in his show, for his opening ceremony. He said, well, you can all use it, you know, elsewhere if you want, but this is the times I want it to be used for the... But we realized we suddenly had a lighting system of 72,000 extra lights, because I could just make the stadium blue, I could make it red, I could make it strobe, I could make it pulse, I could make it do all the things that my lighting system was doing. I could tie in and make it part of my lighting cues. Working in the round is really, it's great on one hand, it's an intimacy, you get close to people, it's a big spectacle, but it has huge drawbacks, and never in the round you never are able to give a background to your stage painting. But now we could do it. So as we would start to write our cues, we would ring up the video people downstairs and I'd say, oh well, our cue, you know, LX53 can also be your cue, video 53. And when the cue is called, not only would our beautiful painting in blues and greens come on, but there would be a marvellous dappled background to it.
So were you actually changing things live?
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, they would have a cue, just like caller, and the show caller would call LX Q53, video Q51.
Yeah, sure.
And at that moment, the lighting and the video would change together to make this beautiful picture.
So you were standing there.
And we very much directed that from our lighting booth, yeah.
It's still an amazing thing to watch. I watched it the other night again just to...
I will never forget that. I can remember driving home on my little scooter during that three-month rehearsal period, sometimes really, really believing that we were going to be party to a disaster. I mean, you have that in many shows. There are always times when you're in tech rehearsal, you go, oh, is this actually going to be any good or not, you know? But the margin between good and bad is so tiny. And other times thinking this could be the greatest thing in the world, you know. But it wasn't until it all came together and with that the sun came out that afternoon. I'm not exaggerating, something that I'm prone to do. I'm not exaggerating when I tell you that it was the first day that it didn't rain in 2.5 months. Every day it rained. And the sun came out and 70,000 people arrived in the stadium and we did this flawless show. And the high the next day was like nothing I've ever felt before. I mean, it was a high. Of course, we were proud of it. But of course, it was just an enormous sense of relief that you hadn't cocked it up in
and
front of the world.
And it got a fantastic reaction.
Yeah, it did. And it really set the Olympics off. In a good way, I think.
Now, it's now 4 decades that you've really been in the business, maybe over 4 decades coming on. What's given you, maybe you've already answered this, but what's given you the most personal satisfaction, all those many projects that you've done?
No, I don't. I mean, yeah, it's quite nice to have one job that you can say was up there, but that the Olympics was good because it was a very big public thing and it was nice to be recognised in, not just by people you normally see pop concerts or operas. That was nice to see one's work seen and appreciated by that many people. And it was a big thing to have pulled off. But I get the same satisfaction I get all the time, really, when, you know, we've just done this musical in London, Bad Out of Hell. And, that, you know, to be at the end of a tech session and to do a rehearsal and it to go beautifully or to do an opening night somewhere where you're looking at it and you think, that's good work, you know. And you remember what it is that got you there to do it and how difficult it might have been to have done it and to see that satisfaction. I get that sort of continuously.
I mean, the very nature of your job means you're away an awful lot.
Yeah, less than I used to be, but still away a lot. Yeah. But, I have a really solid marriage and I have had for 30 years, as long as I work with the Rolling Stones.
Yes.
And that's been makes an enormous difference.
Moving in a world where there's usually a total instability.
I didn't get into drugs. That was the other thing. I never really did the whole thing, which I've seen a lot of careers destroyed by. So I like some order in my life, and I
so like when you're not working, I know you've already said how, you know, for you it is your life, and I think most designers actually wake up in the morning and say, great, you know, because they're doing something that they love. So it's not really, work in the conventional sense. But what do you do when you're not on the occasions that you... I know you have a houseboat, which I think you share.
I have a ship. Not a houseboat. We rather look down on those with houseboats. My boat has an engine.
Oh, it's... okay.
So our apartment in London for the last 15 years has been a boat in the river underneath Albert Bridge.
And I think your brother also shares...
No, he coincidentally, he lives further up on Chelsea Reach. He has a big houseboat. He has a houseboat. Yeah, so that's been part of my life. I mean, the secret is it's not really a proper job. It's not really a proper... It never felt like a proper job to me. It really didn't. I mean, of course, it involves a lot of work, a lot of organisation, obviously some skills set, but it still never has never been a chore. I mean, sometimes you're stuck in some rather miserable place and it's all going rather badly and you're outside and you're cold and wet and you'd rather be at home with your family. But that's a small price to pay, I think, for the high of and the satisfaction of being able to do this sort of work.
So are there any particular areas that you have not worked in yet that you love to work in terms of...
I don't know. I mean, maybe some kind of art installation is quite interesting. But then I thought, and I've done a few things. I did done some installations at the Hoban here and
that's the lighting of the building. In the grounds, little.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And I guess some of the work in Las Vegas, those sort of things you could consider to some degree. But in a way, that's working in isolation. And the one thing that I really enjoy is this idea of collaboration. And again, it's a skill I guess I've learnt over the years of when you come together as a creative team, working out really quickly who's who, what's what, which direction the thing is going in, how you can help, when you should lay back. And that I really like. I'm not sure I could sit in a studio and be, do James Turrelli stuff. But maybe as I get older, maybe that will be rather fun to explore some of that sort of thing.
You told, I had a very nice story that you told, which I'd like you to tell, about your relationship on a project with Stevie Wonder, which I love because it's about, I mean, the very fact that he's blind, so he's talking to a lighting designer.
Well, that was in fact just when I met my wife and Lucy, and it would have been 82. And I was on tour with him, and I used to actually go on tour. I used to travel with him, do the lights. He's an extraordinary man, very big, and smells rather great. He has a very completely unique smell. I don't know what it is, of oils and things that he wears. I always remember that about him. And I would talk. He was very funny. Steve's very funny. And I remember at in rehearsals him coming up and bumping into the lighting board and saying, "What's that?" I said, "Oh, it's a lighting board." And he was fiddling around. He's very au fait with computers and faders and knobs. You know, that stuff he's really good with. And he was pushing up faders. Said, "What colour's that?" I said, "Oh, that's green." "Hey, everybody, look at the green." So he would always do those tricks. But I could talk to him about colour. He would sort of understand the concept of a sexy song being lit in a hot sexy color, which I would explain to him might be red or gold or cool blue thing for cool sad songs. He would sort of understand that, but he used to talk about sight as that other thing, shake his head from side to side, said that other thing. And if you think about it, if I was to say you had a sixth sense, I couldn't possibly explain what that was, however esoteric it is. But what I did realize I could do, I could take away the sense that he doesn't have. I could take that away from everybody else. And so we would have this part in the show where he would say, "Hey, Patrick, turn out the lights." And it was really important that he would say that. Otherwise, people would just think it was some terrible mistake. But we would fade down all the lights, and the musicians would fade down their lights on the stage, and the technicians, the soundboards, the lighting boards, we would turn off the emergency exit sign, and he would start to play Visions of My Mind, beautiful songs, expression of how the world might be and what was going on inside his head. And there was this beautiful 7 minutes, it was a long number, where this connection between the audience and the performer was absolute. Well, of course, it's ironic, and I do tell that story if I'm talking to students, particularly people who are learning this thing, that to say with some pride that your best lighting cue is to turn all the lights out is an irony, but it's also very instructive that explains that lighting is clearly about how you express things using this technology.
Another lighting designer who I know you know, another RDI, Mark Major, he said to me, for him, the best lighting is the night sky from his house in Norfolk. We're coming to the end now, so I always ask this question. What would you say to any young, budding lighting designer? And I hope maybe there are some women in this profession.
Well, Paulie Constable, one of the great light designers, certainly theatrical light designers, so I would say more than half of them, Natasha Katz, all those people, really good. In rock and roll, there are some, you know, more as time goes by.
So what would you say to a young, budding designer that wants to get very much into the world that you're in, which you've been in for many years and a very notable person? What's the profession like for getting in? Because presumably it's different from your time, as you got up from the sort of lowly levels and worked your way in.
Well, it's a question I get asked literally all the time, because a lot of people write to me, students, and I'm always slightly, it's almost like the question comes at me fresh each time, because the answer is I don't really know. You know, when I started, in many ways it was easier because there were few of us, because the industry didn't really exist, you know, and I was lucky enough to have just caught the wave early on and managed to stay on. Well, I'd say a couple of things. First of all, is that lighting is incredibly wide in its breadth of possibilities. So if you want to light rock concerts, of course, that's relatively small niche, but, you know, the people who make livings lighting churches and operas and ballets and television shows and shops and churches and anything. Musical performance, of course, even within musical performances, 100, you know, there's people who I know who only do kind of heavy metal shows. There's a whole jazz circuit. But probably if I use my own career as a kind of microcosm of a direction, it's to try and do everything. Is to really learn about all sorts of lighting and light anything you can, from your sister's wedding to the local band in the local club, you know. And just that, I guess, again, as a parallel, is that time I spent with the heavy metal kids doing, you know, a year of really simple lighting was enough to set me on my way. Of course, I had a lucky break, but, you know, lucky breaks, probably more options for lucky breaks now. I think a lot of it also is down to really keeping yourself together, you know, really having some discipline about yourself,
how you get on with people, how you present yourself,
you know, learning the technology for sure. You know, I think if you can learn how to program a lighting board, you've got a really good start, A, because you can go off and do that for other people as a stepping stone in your career, and be grateful that you have the opportunity to be part of this extraordinary world. You know, it's wonderful, lighting, and it holds an interesting place in the creative world, I think, because it floats in between being something that is of itself and can be done in isolation, and also just as a strength and support for everything from set designers to directors, you know, where you're slotting in with all the other disciplines of creativity, but at times you can really make it sing and be the biggest part of it.
Patrick Woodrell, thank you very much.
Thank you.